This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Ayan Bior, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So they are going to challenge that move and try to force this vote of no confidence to happen maybe as soon as Tuesday, that's tomorrow.
That's VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg talking about an opposition push for a vote of no confidence. Also, in Kenya, lawyers are wearing yellow ribbons to protest what they see as a violation of the rule of law. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, in South Africa, the leaders of the African National Congress have been meeting today to determine the fate of President Jacob Zuma. As of now, no decision has been announced, but Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, the party leader, has said he wants the matter settled today. VOA Southern Africa correspondent Anita Powell spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about what's next in South African politics.
This has been a nail-biter of a week for South African politics. We just heard from the opposition. And when I say the opposition, I mean a coalition of opposition parties united like we've never seen them before. And what they said is that although they have for many years called for Jacob Zuma to go, Jacob Zuma, according to them, is not the problem. It's the ANC itself. They say that this move to remove Zuma and allow Cyril Ramaphosa to sail into his job is just factionalism and isn't doing justice to what the South African people really want, which is an actual change.
Now, there is a proposal for a vote of no confidence, and it's currently scheduled for the 22nd of this month. Is that date holding steady?
At this particular moment, yes. The Speaker of Parliament has denied a request from the opposition to move forward that date to tomorrow. But the opposition is now saying that they are going to go to court with this matter and ask for this to be brought much earlier. So they are going to challenge that move and try to force this vote of no confidence to happen maybe as soon as Tuesday, that's tomorrow.
Now, why has this process taken so long? It's been weeks and weeks and weeks.
Some of Zuma's critics might argue it's been 9 years. But the reason that these negotiations have taken so long, well, if you listen to the head of the ANC, that's Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, he wants to conduct this matter with dignity. He wants to conduct this matter in a gentle way that he says is befitting the father of this nation, Nelson Mandela. What he said yesterday in a speech in Cape Town was that this is the way Mandela might have handled it, with dignity and delicacy. But there's a real politic there, too. Cyril Ramaphosa has a lot to lose. He's the new leader of the ANC and the presumptive new president of South Africa. If he can rally the ANC to victory in 2019, and to do that, he has to make sure the ANC stays united, stays unified, looks credible and respectable, and isn't tearing itself apart. Which is why many observers say he is conducting these matters with such delicacy, because he doesn't want to let the ANC's dirty laundry hang out for everyone to see. There's another side of this, and that is that Jacob Zuma also has a lot to lose. We are aware that he may face the reinstatement of 783 charges of corruption, which is no small thing. What we're hearing from these talks is that he's been asking for protection from prosecution. He's been asking for coverage of his legal fees. And the ANC has said that they're not in a position to grant that. So this is maybe the sticking point.
So what comes next if Mr. Zuma does agree to resign?
So Cyril Ramaphosa is the deputy president, and he will take over as acting president of the country. The State of the Nation address, one assumes, will be given by him. And according to the ANC, there will be a smooth path to elections in 2019. Of course, according to the opposition, they are going to mobilize and demand the dissolution of parliament, the dissolution of cabinet, and call for early elections. So that's what happens after President Zuma's resignation.
Now, if he refuses to resign and the party does a recall, what then?
Okay, so actually, Kate, that is kind of a different thing. So the next step, now that President Zuma has apparently held firm in his refusal to resign, is that he could face the music in Parliament. This would be his ninth vote of no confidence from Parliament. And the last one, you'll recall, passed by pretty narrow margin. He was saved by 198 votes to 177. And now that his own party is gunning for him, it's likely to go through, and then he will have to resign. He does not have to resign if the National Executive Committee of the ANC asks him to resign. He's not obligated to, if they recall him. He can choose, and he can go before Parliament and face what could be a very humiliating discussion and debate ahead of this no confidence vote.
That was VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg speaking with Kate Pound Dawson today. Kenyan lawyers are donning yellow ribbons this week to protest what they say are violations of the rule of law in the wake of opposition leader Raila Odinga's self-inauguration late last month. Odinga has rejected a call from Western diplomats to recognize Uhuru Kenyatta as the legitimately elected president. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Some lawyers in courts could be seen wearing a yellow ribbon, a way to show their displeasure with the state and some government officials for failing to obey several court orders. Isaac Okero is the president of the Law Society of Kenya.
What we are doing now is to embark on this campaign to protest the high levels of impunity, and specifically when it reaches a point where state and public officers can flagrantly disobey court orders, then we know that we are in dangerous waters.
The LSK said it suspended a plan to boycott the court sessions, saying it is still consulting with its members. Recently, Miguna Miguna, a lawyer who played a prominent role in Odinga's self-inauguration on January 30th, was arrested and faced treason charges. A court had ordered Miguna's release, but the government failed to comply and sent him to Canada. Miguna holds Kenyan and Canadian citizenship. The state is also accused of disobeying a court order after failing to switch on three independent TV stations. The broadcasters say the government orchestrated a media blackout to prevent live coverage of Odinga swearing in as the so-called People's President. The stations are now back on the air. In a statement Sunday, the US Ambassador Robert Godek and envoys from several European Union nations called on Odinga to recognize President Uhuru Kenyatta's administration. Speaking at a public gathering in Nairobi, however, Odinga told the envoys to stay out of Kenyan affairs.
We want to tell them in clear terms, Kenya is an independent country, and Kenyan problems will be resolved by the Kenyan people. They can only be part of the government.
Some of Odinga's key allies have been arrested and had their passports withdrawn. The security detail for some opposition lawmakers has also been withdrawn. Odinga boycotted an October rerun of the August presidential election. Kenyatta received 98% of the vote in the October polling. The Western envoys also called on the Kenyan government to comply with the court orders and respect freedom of speech. Raphael Tuju is the ruling Jubilee Party Secretary General. He says the opposition coalition National Super Alliance, or NASA, has disobeyed more court orders, and he accused some judges of being biased.
So we have this situation where you almost say that the Supreme Court and the Constitutional Court sometimes are just winking at NASA, to the extent that we begin to wonder whether they are an extension of NASA. Now, of course, we do understand that this is a very complicated country, so some judges have more of their loyalty to their ethnic communities as opposed to loyalty to the law.
This Thursday, lawyers are expected to march in the streets to pressure the government to respect the constitution and the laws. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Wading into a scenario of mounting regional tensions, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson began a five-nation visit to the Middle East in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, where he called for next month's presidential elections to be transparent and credible. The top U.S. diplomat met Monday with Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry and touched on topics including economic and military cooperation and the fight against terrorism. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Secretary Tillerson held a joint news conference with Egyptian Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry at the old Foreign Ministry compound, highlighting topics of concern to both countries, including the fight against terrorism and U.S. concerns about Egypt's presidential elections. Both men stressed that they had agreed not to interfere in each other's internal affairs. Tillerson noted that both he and Shoukry had discussed the promotion and protection of human rights and the vital role of civil society in Egypt, along with issues related to the upcoming Egyptian presidential election in March, in which incumbent President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is running largely unopposed.
The United States, as it does in all countries, supports a transparent and credible electoral process, and all citizens being given the right and the opportunity to participate freely and fairly.
When asked about alleged political oppression in Egypt, Foreign Minister Shoukry responded that the political process takes a long time to evolve, but that Egyptians have expressed their views at the ballot box, along with changing their government several times during the past 7 years.
Development in the social and political field is an evolutionary process. I think over the last 11 years, the Egyptian people have shown their commitment and the determination and their ability to change their course and to indicate their dissatisfaction. If they deemed that they were dissatisfied, they have been able to change two governments in the last 7 years, and they have undertaken legislative elections and know how to protect their rights and to advocate.
Secretary Tillerson stressed that both the U.S. and Egypt were determined to jointly pursue the fight against terrorism, and that Egypt was a key member of the U.S.-led coalition against the so-called Islamic State group.
We agreed that we would continue our close cooperation on counterterrorism measures, including our joint commitment to the defeat of ISIS. And Egypt has been a very important member of the Defeat ISIS coalition from the beginning. Egypt deals with the threats of ISIS themselves and are dealing with it certainly currently in the Sinai.
Egypt began a countrywide anti-terrorism operation dubbed Sinai 2018 on Friday and has been launching airstrikes against terrorist targets, including arms caches, as well as attempting to disrupt arms supply routes from Libya and Gaza. In response to an Arab journalist's question about U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel, Tillerson insisted that the U.S. remain committed to the peace process and that several key points of the president's decision were being misinterpreted.
In the announcement President Trump made regarding Jerusalem, he also made two very important points as well, one of which was he was not advocating for any change to the status quo as to oversight of the holy sites, recognizing the proper role of existing authorities. And the second is that the final boundaries of Jerusalem are yet to be determined, and that those will be decided among the parties.
When asked about Egypt's relations with North Korea, Foreign Minister Shoukry pointed out that many U.S. allies also have diplomatic ties with Pyongyang, but went on to stress that economic and other ties were minimal.
Egypt has had normal diplomatic ties with North Korea, as does many Western and NATO members, and those ties are, in terms of the relationship, limited to representation, and there is almost no existing economic or other areas of cooperation.
Secretary Tillerson added that the U.S. was still evaluating eventual diplomatic negotiations with North Korea, but pointed out that it's up to Pyongyang to decide when they're ready to engage with the U.S. in a sincere and meaningful way, since they know what has to be on the table for discussions. Tillerson met with President al-Sisi at the Al-Ittihadiyya Presidential Palace before heading to the airport and continuing his tour that will include stops in Kuwait, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The United Nations is embarked on a year-long campaign to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the UN General Assembly on December 10, 1948. Rights activists say the declaration is as relevant today as it was when drafted 7 decades ago. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was drafted in Paris in 1948 by a diverse group of countries under the leadership of former First Lady of the United States, Eleanor Roosevelt. The declaration was designed to prevent the repetition of the horrific human rights violations that were committed during World War II. The common thread in the Universal Declaration is that of anti-discrimination, the belief that everyone is equal and everyone has the same rights. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says many of the world's human rights violations and problems stem from the failure to uphold that principle.
I think in the current climate, a lot of those issues are really crystallizing. You look at the Me Too movement. So even with all the advances that have been on women's rights over the past 70 years, and there have been huge advances in women's rights. Nevertheless, you know, suddenly you get the Me Too movement, and suddenly we all realize there's all sorts of ghastly stuff going on affecting women, even the most privileged women in the most democratic and well-established countries.
Colville notes human rights are not a given. He says it is a continuous struggle to get them, and once that has been achieved, to keep them. Human rights advocates believe in the Universal Declaration's resilience, but they acknowledge this essential document will be challenged in the years ahead by new complex issues, including rights to privacy and freedom of expression in the Internet age, and the threat climate change poses to the right to life, food, water, and housing. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Cape Town, South Africa, the countdown continues to day zero, presently scheduled for May 11th, when city officials will turn off the water supply to most homes in the city of 4 million people. Residents will have to line up for severely rationed water under the watch of security forces. The Cape Town region is suffering one of its worst ever droughts, with reservoirs at record low levels. The crisis means people are adopting new measures to save water. Darren Taylor reports.
Elsa Finka opens a sachet to reveal what looks like a white pill. She drips 4 teaspoons of water onto it. It puffs up into a gel-soaked cotton wipe. Finka uses the wipe to clean her arms.
Oh, it feels too slimy, and that's like a normal gel.
The gel's also available in plastic bottles, and she squeezes it over her hands. Ludwig Marishane is the inventor of the dry bath. He says 15 milliliters of gel is enough to wash an entire body. His formula contains natural oils and tawas.
It's a crystal rock from Asia. You wash yourself with water, and typically you use this crystal rock as your soap. Over 80% of the product is water. We've got moisturizers in there. So it's safe. It's dermatologically tested for use on sensitive skin, and it can even be used on genital areas without any adverse effects.
Marishane got the idea for dry bath in 2007 at the age of 17 at high school in a rural village in South Africa's Limpopo province. Like other inhabitants, he had to endure long lines for water at a communal tap.
A friend of mine had mentioned that he would have liked for somebody to invent something that could clean someone's body without the need for water. And the reason for that was because we were using the bucket bath method of staying clean. So Cape Town might be experiencing a drought now, and everybody has to use the bucket bath. 60% of the world lives like that every single day.
Finka's family was once part of this statistic.
We grew up collecting water from the river. We collected only water we could drink. But when we need to do washing, we would go to the river and do washing there.
But many Cape Townians don't have Finka's life experience of struggling for water. So, says Marishane, it has taken them years to accept the dry bath. He says this is because most people are convinced that bathing and showering are the only ways to maintain cleanliness.
But with the drought, it's forcing them to say, whether I like it or not, a solution like this is actually a savior for me, because it would literally cut my water hygiene needs in half for the month. So like one dry bath bottle can substitute 15 washes, which is basically half a month of cleaning up.
Marishane says the product can be used for 6 consecutive days, after which the user can wash with water to clear oil buildup on the skin. At the moment, dry bath costs about $1.60 per wash or sachet, but Marishane is trying to reduce this to about 40 cents per unit to make it cheaper for more people to save more water.
For the average modern household, we're saving between 80 to 150 liters each time somebody skips the shower or bath.
As Cape Town edges towards day zero, an advantage like this means the sold-out sign is now up on the dry bath website.
In the past week, we've sold 10 times more than what we typically sell in a month. We already put in an order for about 100,000 washes that should be getting delivered next week, and then we've got more orders coming in to fulfill.
But it's not only the Cape drought that's spurring Marishane on to grow his business. As temperatures around the world soar, so too do dry baths international sales.
California's been in a drought for the past 4 years, so that's one of the markets where we've got a high demand for the product. Japan experienced one as well last year. India's going through a very severe one at the moment.
Marishane's rags-to-riches story and his charisma mean he's now a popular motivational speaker.
Google named me as one of the brightest young minds in the world. I was the best student entrepreneur in the world, the first African to get that accolade. And one thing that really puzzles me is I did all of this just because I didn't want to bath. Thank you.
Marishane enjoys his success, but he maintains he'd much rather sell dry bath to people who naturally conserve water than to those compelled to do so by a disastrous drought. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the former president of Liberia, will receive the $5 million Mo Ibrahim Prize, which recognizes excellence in African leadership. Johnson Sirleaf stepped down from office last month, the first democratic transition of power in Liberia since 1944. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate was Africa's first female elected head of state. She served 2 6-year terms, but under Liberia's constitution, was not eligible to run again. Dr. Salim Ahmed Salim, the chair of the prize committee, said in announcing the award that Johnson Sirleaf led a process of reconciliation that focused on building a nation and its democratic institutions after years of conflict in Liberia. The prize was created by Sudanese telecom tycoon Mo Ibrahim. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight.
I'm Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. Tune in next week on Health Chat for an exclusive interview with Professor Isaac Folorunso, Minister of Health of the Republic of Nigeria, and Dr. Patrick Abuache, Director of the Family Health Division for the Ghana Health Service. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-691-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis. We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.